Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's May 15th, 2020 program, The Lasting Impact of the Internment of Japanese Americans. This is the 32nd program for our 2019-20 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the newly elected City Club president. For the foreseeable future, we will be taping our forums and uploading them to our Facebook page and to our YouTube page. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. University of Oregon. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And Lane Community College. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. We would also like to acknowledge the generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. On to the program. One of the great racial stains on the history of America was the internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II. The forced removal from society profoundly affected adults and children and influenced subsequent generations who never saw the inside of the camps. I first became aware of the internment in an odd way. In 1967, as student body president of a large public high school in Long Beach, California, I was greeted by having a new principal, a decorated Army colonel who had played an important role in the forced removal of Japanese Americans to detention centers and internment camps in the West. I was focused on trying to get the high school administration to listen to student complaints about over-restrictive dress codes in the 1960s. And as you might imagine, our colonel principal was not eager to relax those standards. And that experience ended up motivating me to understand better how those in power influencing both the framing of social issues and institutional responses to them. And in an American history class at that high school, when students invited a Japanese American to give his perspective on the impact of internment, our colonel principal declined to attend or even to address the issue. The whole experience awakened a previously dormant social activism in me that eventually compelled me to study sociology at Yale University and at the University of California, Santa Cruz. In the sociology PhD program at UCSC, I was also fortunate to have a member who helped create a way to study the framing and addressing of social problems that came to dominate the field. He was John Itsuru Katsusi, who in 1942 had been incarcerated in California at the Manzanar internment camp and went on to earn a BA at Boston University and a PhD at UCLA. Together with Leonard Broom, Katsusi wrote The Managed Casualty, The Japanese-American Family in World War II, first published in 1956, and later republished in 1976, at a time when the American public was more ready to confront issues of social injustice and possible restitution. The book focused on case studies of 10 Japanese-American families and the impact of their incarceration in World War II. Legal historians generally consider the U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding the forced internment of Japanese-Americans to be one of the worst decisions the country ever made. In today's program, you will learn about the number of people interned, the history of the incarceration nationally, and the lingering impact on descendants of the detainees. You will also hear about how the internment camp was carried out here in Eugene. One young boy in one of the camps was Roger Shimamura, who grew up to be an internationally acclaimed artist and educator. Much of his art portrays life in the camps with haunting images of tricycles and baseball inside barbed wire. Information about images of his art intended to be on display at the Jordan Snitzer Museum of Art through mid-June, are accessible online at the JSMA website, jsma.uoregon.edu. I would like to thank Joel Corin, Chair of the City Club Program Committee, for organizing today's program, which promises to be one of the most compelling we've had in recent memory. We have three speakers for today's program: Tara Fickle, Amy Yogi, and Anne Rose Kitagawa. Tara Fickle is an assistant professor of English at the University of Oregon and an affiliated faculty member of the Ethnic Studies Department, the New Media and Culture Certificate, and the Center for Asian and Pacific Studies. She earned her PhD from the University of California, Los Angeles, and her BA from Wesleyan University. Her 2019 book, The Race Card, From Gaming Technologies to Model Minorities, published by NYU Press, explores how games have been used to both establish and combat Asian and Asian American racial stereotypes. Amy Yogi graduated from the University of Oregon and worked more than 30 years at the UO Knight Library. In addition to working with Oregon Asian Celebration, the Asian American Council, and the Sacred Heart Hospice, she has served as president of the Japanese American Association of Lane County since 2013. She has researched the history of Japanese internment in Eugene and led the effort to build a memorial to the victims of the internment. Anne Rose Kitagawa studied Asian art at Oberlin College and Princeton University and did curatorial work at the Art Institute of Chicago, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and Harvard University Art Museums. In 2010, she came to Eugene to become the chief curator of collections in Asian arts at UO's Jordan Snitzer Museum of Art. There, she's responsible for all Asian art exhibitions, publications, and programs. Deviating from her normal curatorial duties, she organized the American exhibit featuring Shimomura's work. This project grew out of her longtime admiration of and sensitivity to the aesthetic, social, and political issues raised by his beautiful and provocative art. Tara, we will start with you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to thank the Eugene City Club for hosting this discussion. I am Tara Fickle. I am an assistant professor of English at the University of Oregon, and I specialize in Asian American literature and culture from a trans-Pacific perspective. And I'm going to switch now to screen share to show you my first book, The Race Card, which examined how gaming, from gambling to video games, as well as gaming metaphors, have historically shaped Asian and Asian American racial stereotypes. So today, I'll be setting the stage with some historical and social context that I hope will help you fully appreciate the rich accounts of Japanese American life and art that my colleagues Amy and Anne will be providing. In the first half, I'll be introducing some terms that will allow us to speak more precisely and with greater nuance about what has historically been described as the Japanese American internment. And following that, providing an overview of the general timeline and major historical milestones of the events, as well as a discussion of some of their social and political ramifications. Let me start then by talking a bit about terminology, because even before getting into the history, it's important to note that the words that we use to talk about that history really matter. So this is a quote from a Japanese American internment resource, densho.org, a really rich one that I encourage you all to check out. And I think it captures this sentiment. As it says, when we use language that distorts the past, we lose our ability to recognize patterns of repeating history. But language that imparts truth and understanding can help us avoid repeating those same mistakes today. And the reason that matters here is because euphemistic, distorting language has been and continues to be used to downplay just how violent, racially motivated, and devastating incarceration really was for the Japanese American population. As a result, the convention now in the scholarly and activist communities has been to deliberately refuse to accept the way that the government talked about this as a, quote, evacuation or a resettlement or internment, and to call it for what it was and what it is: an unconstitutional, unjust, forced removal and incarceration of Americans, two-thirds of whom were American citizens. One of the most important points about terminology, and this I think gets to the heart of the issue about why the incarceration has historically not received the attention that it would otherwise have, is the way that we talk about the camps specifically. Something little mentioned is that when President Roosevelt, U.S. representatives, and the War Relocation Authority first began informing the public about the presence of the camps in 1942, they in fact deliberately used the term concentration camps. At that time, as you know, there was not the same degree of widespread knowledge about the extent of what was occurring under the Nazi regime in the constellation of another set of concentration camps, which have now in the scholarly and political discourse come to be more accurately defined for what they were, which is to say extermination or death camps. The reason I say that this seemingly semantic matter really gets at the heart of the issue is not just me speaking as a literature professor who's obsessed with the way that language works. It's because the horrors of the Japanese-American experience have never really been understood on their own, but always in comparison to the Jewish experience and the experience of the many other groups targeted by the Nazis. As the Japanese-American documentarian Emiko Omori put it, one of the reasons that we didn't talk about camp for so long wasn't because it wasn't bad, but because it wasn't bad enough. So shifting our terminology here is about naming the camps for what they were, American concentration camps, and not in any way to diminish or to equate the two experiences. So to continue on with terminology, part of what makes the situation not just unjust, but as I said before, unconstitutional, is that the majority of Japanese Americans imprisoned were what we call Nisei, or second generation. The distinction between generations is a very important one, not only in pre-war Japanese American communities, but also in terms of how the groups were differentiated and treated by the American government and military authorities. So the second terminology difference that I want to emphasize is between the Nisei and the Issei. So Issei refers in Japanese to the first generation of immigrants to America, with the largest waves beginning around the mid-19th century. The Issei, oftentimes single men, but some women and couples as well, were classified by the U.S. as so-called aliens ineligible for citizenship. Because they didn't fall under the category of free white persons and later free black persons that the U.S. used to determine citizenship eligibility, Issei could not be naturalized until 1952. As a result, they could not enjoy the privileges of citizenship, including not just voting or legal protection, but also property ownership, crucial for the kind of agricultural and entrepreneurial work whereby many early Japanese immigrants made their living. And it's important to note that this kind of legally sanctioned discrimination against Asian Americans, which culminated in the incarceration, was part of a much longer history of racial discrimination against Asian labor and anti-immigrant exclusion sentiment, starting with Chinese laborers who arrived in the 1830s and then in waves with Filipino, Korean, and South Asian immigrants, many of whom worked in agricultural industries. So although Pearl Harbor is often taken as the inciting incident of the Japanese-American incarceration, in fact, the history goes much deeper, just as its afterlife continues to today. So to return to the question of generation, despite the best efforts of American nativists to disenfranchise and eject Asians, the children of the first generation Issei, called the second generation Nisei, who were born on American soil, were eligible for citizenship under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And as such, they served a really crucial bridge role for their parents in terms of being able to communicate with various institutions and, say, have property registered in their name. This differential power structure, in which the children legally possessed more power than their parents and were seen as more, quote, American or loyal than their enemy alien parents, caused severe and long-lasting schisms in the Japanese-American community. And one of the first ways that we saw this was in the wake of Pearl Harbor. So as I'm sure you all know, and in some cases may have even personally experienced, on December 7th, 1941, the Pearl Harbor military base in Hawaii was bombed by Japan, with over 3,500 service people being wounded or killed. Within 48 hours of this event, nearly 1,300 Issei, or first generation Japanese Americans, mostly male heads of households, were arrested with no formal charges under suspicion of being enemy collaborators. For many of them, the extent of the crime they committed was subscribing to a Japanese language magazine or being part of a Buddhist Shinto community. And for many of them, they would spend months or even years separated from their families in internment camps in the true sense of that word, that is, camps for detaining enemy aliens in a time of war. Although the next major milestone in this history is usually the signing of Executive Order 9066 2 months later, which essentially authorized the exclusion of anyone from anywhere in the US without trial, it's important to get a sense of the kind of anti-Japanese rhetoric and climate that was endemic in the post-Pearl Harbor moment, and in fact, in the months leading up to Pearl Harbor as well. Not only were the vigilante attacks on Japanese Americans in the street, and in fact on other Asians mistaken as Japanese in one murder that took place, but there were many propaganda images filled with racist caricatures that equated Japanese Americans with disloyal enemies within. So in a widely circulated newspaper comic like this one, the style of which you may recognize as none other than Dr. Seuss, you hear a procession of Japanese Americans lining up for explosives, which according to popular myth, they might use to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge and sabotage military operations. Of course, not one single legitimate case of espionage was ever discovered. Not to mention, by the way, that a massive proportion of the prisoners, who again were American-born citizens, had not only never been to Japan, but couldn't even speak Japanese well enough to be able to serve as translators intercepting Japanese military broadcasts when they volunteered for the army. They actually had to go to language school to be trained. So you can judge for yourself the logic behind this justification and rhetoric that Japanese Americans were these sleeper agents. So with the signing of the executive order, the, quote, evacuation of Japanese Americans began in earnest. Families in designated zones along the West Coast were often given as little as a week to prepare, which included not only shuttering or liquidating their businesses and their homes, but whittling down the entirety of their possessions into what they could carry, attempting to find another home for their pets, and preparing as best they could for the harsh desert conditions of the camps. Initially, while the camps were being built, about 90,000 Japanese Americans were transported to the euphemistically described assembly centers, where they were held in abysmal conditions. These were often hastily adapted arenas and fairgrounds, where families were forced to house in what were essentially livestock stalls for months. In May 1942, incarcerees began to be transferred to the 10 permanent camps. And the conditions in these camps was, if imaginable, even more desolate than the temporary assembly centers because of their location in barren desert land. So innumerable accounts of camp life will talk about the extreme temperature changes, the blazing sun combined with the frigid nights, and the endless dust storms they faced in camp. At the same time, a bare bones infrastructure in camp meant that not only was there a tiny amount of living space and inadequate privacy, but families had to eat in mass family mealtime and parental authority, and incarcerees had to run from one end of the block to the other to use huge open bathroom and shower facilities, while also dealing with inadequate nutrition, medical care, and educational resources. So obviously there's a significant amount to say about the massive scale of human life that was altered and managed here, and there are many great books and documentaries about those details if you're interested. In the interest of time, I'll just briefly name some final milestones. The first in camp was the so-called loyalty questionnaire, a form distributed by the military in camps beginning in late 1943, which asked a series of invasive questions about people's family background, religious preferences, bank accounts, and eventually about their willingness to serve in the U.S. military. At first, following the imposition of the draft, this was intended only for Nisei men of military serving age in advance of the draft that was imposed in early 1944. Eventually, however, it was used as a general questionnaire that was issued to all incarcerees over the age of 17. And the two questions that caused the greatest fury and concern in camp were 27 and 28. And they read, "Are you willing to serve in the armed forces of the United States on combat duty wherever ordered?" And number 28, "Will you swear unqualified allegiance to the United States and forswear any form of allegiance or obedience to the Japanese emperor, to any other foreign government, power, or organization?" So the problem with these questions is in part, of course, the injustice of being asked to serve a country that has just unjustly imprisoned you. But it also, again, goes back to the question of generation. Answering yes to question 28, in other words, forswearing allegiance to the emperor, would effectively leave the Issei, the first generation, stateless people, as a could not be U.S. citizens. Whereas it made no sense at all for Nisei to answer number 28 because they had never sworn allegiance to the emperor in the first place. So these kinds of contradictions reveal the way that the government, the U.S. government, really understood Japanese immigrants and Japanese American citizens as equivalent to enemy aliens and in fact loyal subjects of Japan. One of the things that this quick history I've given you conceals, and which I really want to emphasize, though, is that the response among the Japanese American community to this rapid-fire series of traumas, shocks, and injustices was neither even nor passive. There were several organized areas of concerted resistance, including a number of court cases filed on behalf of Japanese Americans, three of which eventually reached the Supreme Court. But beyond this, there was not a single mind directing the community. Perhaps most infamous here, though, was the role played by the JACL, the Japanese American Citizens League, which, as the name suggests, was restricted only to Japanese American citizens, meaning Nisei or later generations, usually quite young people in their 20s or even teens. This organization was essentially elevated by the American government as a particularly loyal, all-American group that was taken as a representative voice of all incarcerees. And this became a way of controlling and giving the Nisei power over the more experienced older Issei generation, which caused significant in-camp friction. Of course, not all Nisei agreed with the JACL, but it did advocate an ultra-patriotic stance, both in initially complying with the evacuation order, but also about responding to the loyalty questionnaire and agreeing to be drafted. And those who did get drafted, by the way, or who volunteered for the Army, were placed in a segregated all-Nisei unit called the 442nd, which remains to this day the most decorated unit in U.S. military history. In August 1945, following the surrender of Japan, the war is officially over. But this, of course, does not mean that Japanese Americans can simply return to their lives as normal. So although the government had slowly been releasing those whom it considered low risk beginning in early 1945, in many cases there were no businesses or homes to return to, and certainly the end of the war did not mean the end of anti-Japanese sentiment. In fact, many Japanese Americans faced discrimination and even outright violence, in addition to the serious long-term mental health, economic, and familial damage caused by the incarceration. So I'll stop there, and hopefully this was a useful scaffolding to help frame some of the really interesting stories that Amy is about to share.
Okay, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share the events of the Japanese Americans in Eugene in 1942. The source of this information is from the correspondence of Carl Onthank, who was the University of Oregon Dean of Personnel Administration. He led the actions in support of 22 Japanese American students at the University of Oregon at this time. Lauren Kessler's book, Stubborn Twig, which is a history of the Yasui family, mentions Onthank in a footnote of the university's effort at that time. His correspondence, which is in the University Library Special Collections, substantiates this timeline. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which created the Western Defense Command to ensure the security of the Pacific states during World War II. Using this mandate, the military decided on the forced removal and imprisonment of all persons of Japanese ancestry into concentration camps. By June, the coast would be cleared of all Japanese Americans. In Lane County, three Japanese Americans registered at the Civil Control Station, 34 West 6th Avenue, which is the site of the Holt Center for the Performing Arts in Eugene. They were Chie Arai, Woodrow Ichihashi, and Hitoshi Watanabe. All were students of the University of Oregon. On March 8, the university's YMCA dormitory received a letter from the national office. It inquired about the university's effort to support international students from Asia whose countries were in the midst of a world war. Carl Onthank replied that there were two Japanese students who had already been picked up by the federal authorities, but what, he asked, was being done for the Japanese American students. With 22 Japanese American students, the university was the center of the Japanese American population in Lane County. Here are their names: Chie Arai, Harry Yoshino Fukuda, Midori Funitake, Mary Furusho, Frank Hachia, Ted Hachia, Thomas Hayashi, Woodrow Ichihashi, Kenji Inohara, Harold Ito, Makoto Iwashita, Grace Ikuko Kumazawa, Alice Kawasaki, Takuo Kawauchi, Samuel Teruhide Naito, Kenzo Nakagawa, Ellen Ogawa, Lawrence Takei, George Uchiyama, Hitoshi Kin Watanabe, Michi Yasui, Robert Shu Yasui. On Thanks said in his letter, most of them are keen, alert young men and women headed toward professional and important business activity. They are surprisingly unresentful of the popular demand to move them back from the coast. They are, after all, American citizens, and we shall have them to live with and deal with anyway. It appears to me that this network might perform an important service, particularly toward easing the way for them to transfer from coast universities to institutions in non-defense areas. A week later, on March 17, he wrote to his cohorts at universities along the West Coast. There were an estimated 2,500 Japanese-American students in colleges. The University of Washington had 456, Berkeley had 420, UCLA had 250, and USC had 131. Although UO had a small enrollment, Onthank expressed how unfair it was that the students had their education interrupted because of the actions of another country, Japan. By March 19, representatives of the largest West Coast universities and the national YMCA and YWCA organizations met in Berkeley to establish a network which would become known as the National Japanese American Student Relocation Council. On March 28, Minoru Yasui, who is the University of Oregon Law School's first Japanese American graduate, challenged the military curfew in Portland, Oregon. He was jailed in solitary confinement, briefly stripped of his citizenship, convicted, and imprisoned in a concentration camp for the duration of the war. He would spend the rest of his life fighting the injustice of Executive Order 9066. By March 31st, the university administration assured their students that if they registered with the Relocation Council, they would be transferred to a college inland to continue their studies. Upon admission, a representative would pick them up, whether they were in an assembly center or internment camp, and drop them off at the university. In the meantime, colleges and universities were asked to admit these students to programs and medical schools. At the U of O, 16 registered with the Relocation Council, 4 opted to return home to help their families into the concentration camps. On May 9th, U of O President Donald Erb reported to his staff that a waiver that they had requested to permit Michi Yasui to attend graduation exercises was denied by the wartime Civil Control Administration. Michi Yasui had completed coursework for an elementary education degree and was set to graduate. Or the ceremony was at 8 p.m. May 31st. The university had offered full supervision during graduation and escort to boarding the train on the assigned date. The denial implied that the order to evacuate would occur before May 31st. So on May 13, Michi stood outside the train station in Eugene at night, trying to catch a glimpse of her mother and younger siblings who were on a train bound for incarceration in California. She did not see them as the window curtains were drawn, but they later reported that they saw her standing in the dark. When attendance to the graduation ceremony was denied, she boarded a train to Denver and joined her brother, who had left Eugene earlier that year. He said she could finish her degree at the University of Denver and find work. May 23rd was the date when movement in and out of Eugene stopped for Japanese Americans. The evacuation poster that you see covered Lane, Lake, Jackson, Curry, Coos, Josephine, and Klamath counties. The U of O students from Lane County were assigned to Tule Lake and Heart Mountain internment camps. By May 31st, 1942, the National Japanese American Relocation Council was established by the YMCA and the YWCA. The American Friends Service Committee managed the tracking of the young students and transported them to the new educational institutions. On June 3rd, 1942, all Japanese Americans who remained in Eugene were sent and imprisoned in unknown military destinations for unknown lengths of time, taking with them only what they could carry. By September 1943, the Relocation Council had placed 5,000 Japanese American students in 529 colleges and universities. This information will be added to the Eugene Japanese American Memorial. And the Friends of the Japanese American Memorial say that this memorial plaza serves to remind us that racist fears should never result in the targeting, internment, and incarceration of any individual or group without due process of law as stated in the U.S. Constitution. And the final word I have here is from Minoru Yasui. If we believe in equality and democracy, then each of us, when we see or believe errors are being made, has an obligation to make every effort to correct them. Thank you. And here is Anne Rose Kitagawa, who will present on the Roger Shimomura exhibit at Jordan Schnitzer Art Museum.
Thank you so much. I'm going to begin with a video that we shot of the exhibition, which unfortunately, because of the pandemic, is not currently accessible to walk-in visitors to the museum. So please forgive me for a moment.
Roger Shimomura channels his outrage and despair into beautiful, provocative art. Using a brightly colored pop art style, he depicts a combination of traditional Japanese imagery and exaggerated cultural stereotypes, creating powerful works that interrogate pop cultural icons, race, self-portraiture, and current political affairs, all interpreted through his family's World War II internment experience. When Shimomura was a student, pop art was understood to be cool and detached. He longed to make it hot and relevant. One hallmark of his work is the use of dark humor to lampoon hypocrisy and promote social justice. He explores the experiences of forever foreigners, visual minorities perceived as outsiders, and the terrible toll that such judgments can take during times of political strife. This exhibition is drawn primarily from the collection of Jordan Schnitzer and augmented with loans from the artist, Sherry Leedy Contemporary Art, and the Greg Kucera Gallery.
So I'm back to my PowerPoint. So it's a real pleasure to be able to speak about the Roger Shimomura exhibition, which was a labor of love on the part of the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at the University of Oregon, where I work. So first, let's discuss Roger Shimomura. Roger Shimomura was born in Seattle in 1939, and along with the rest of his family, had the dubious honor of becoming a guest of the government, first being sent to a Camp Harmony, one of the so-called assembly centers, and then ultimately to their final destination, to Minidoka, Minidoka Relocation Center in Hunt, Idaho. After the internment, the family moved briefly to Chicago and then back to Seattle, where he finished his schooling and wanted badly, actually, to go into art, but his father wanted him to go into the military. And he ended up spending time in the ROTC, and he served for a couple of years in the Army, but ultimately went back to art school, first at the University of Washington in Seattle, and then to Syracuse, where he studied painting and performance art. During the time that he was at Syracuse, pop art was the rage in New York. And he was really struck by pop art and its ability to grab people with colorful pop cultural images of the type that he himself grew up consuming. A lot of Shimomura's art deals with the issue of being a forever foreigner, someone who has a mask that he can't take off, that is perceived by others as a foreigner, but in fact he is a third generation Japanese American. Not only was he born in the United States, his parents were as well. So his remembrances of the internment are not the remembrances of an adult, of a child. And this is a picture from a yearbook from Minidoka, where I've tried valiantly, but I think failed, to give you a close-up in the left-hand side, where you can see Shimomura as a very small child wearing overalls. So his experiences of the internment were the experiences, of course, of a child. And he speaks with a tiny bit of nostalgia about it, in the sense that the upheaval that Tara so eloquently described resulted in a kind of more playtime for a child to spend with other friends. But the internment was, of course, a mixed experience, and the close proximity of the military to small children is something that he has never really been able to shake. The internment experience, as Tara also described, these are photographs of Minidoka, show it in the blazing sun, in the pouring rain, and in the freezing cold. And this is kind of the backdrop for a lot of his internment-related art. So as I had mentioned, pop art was the thing that really excited him. And pop art is often personified through Roy Lichtenstein and Andy Warhol, two great favorites of Shimomura's. And Shimomura began to produce hybrid images in which he would juxtapose pop art style, that is a sort of comic book flat, impostoless portrayal of whatever it is that you're showing, often iconic figures. And in these cases, he's juxtaposed images from the so-called floating world of Edo period Japan. So beautiful courtesans looking into mirrors, and what do they see? In fact, they see Marilyn Monroe or Elizabeth Taylor's faces. So works that harness humor as a vehicle, but do actually have a rather pointed undertone. So these are the two aspects, ukiyo-e on the one hand and pop art on the other hand. And again, he's created images that are direct quotations, in this case from Andy Warhol, with that iconic Marilyn image, juxtaposed with two foodstuffs that are associated with either American or Japanese people, saltine crackers and ramen. So when he turns his focus towards the internment, there are many different ways in which he's engaged with it. Some of them are quite documentary. So this is a trilogy that he created in consultation with a poet, three discrete prints that represent the before, during, and after of the internment. Before represented, of course, by the bombing of Pearl Harbor on the left. In the center, a kind of evocative and heartbreaking image of a small child riding a tricycle with a beautiful sunset in that desolate landscape and surrounded by barbed wire. And the image on the right represents the return home, a return that was not necessarily a welcome return to a neighborhood that may not have welcomed people. So what he's done in this particular case is not so much harnessing art, but harnessing a documentary image of a woman saying, "Japs keep moving, this is a white man's neighborhood." So really heartbreaking images, but produced in such a way that they are appealing. And my overall sensation of Shimomura's work is this beautifully designed kind of candy-colored world in which discrimination reaches out and grabs you by the lapels. So some of the other effective ways in which he has described the experience are quite evocative and poetic. This particular series is a series of small prints called Mistaken Identities. And each one of them has a subtitle that is a dedication to an individual or a different artist. So in this case, Mistaken Identities for Tokyo Ueyama, you see Shimomura's image on the left. And on the right, you see an actual watercolor painting by a Japanese American artist Tokyo Ueyama, a portrait that he did of his wife sitting in the barrack looking out at Topaz, which Shimomura has, of course, recast in this charming way as an Edo period beauty in the style of Suzuki Harunobu. But in fact, when you unpack that image and you look carefully at it, you realize, wait, what you're seeing in the background are barracks. So what looks like a charming image actually has this undertow of sadness. Likewise, you have his mistaken identities image in honor of Ansel Adams, in which case he has taken a quotation from a book that Adams produced called Born Free and Equal. Adams produced this book during World War II as his pictorial essay showing that this was a completely unconstitutional act for these people to be imprisoned. And I think that Shimomura has taken the face of a kabuki actor and placed it there in homage to this beautiful image of a person that was photographed in Ansel Adams' original publication. Adams was, of course, vilified for this. These books were burnt during the war. Another image from the same series, Mistaken Identities for Seattle PI. What you see looking like an Utamaro image of a mother and child, you realize, because of the tag around the child's neck, actually refers to the so-called evacuation in which families were uprooted and moved. And this is one of the earliest photos that was produced showing people being evacuated, this from Bainbridge Island. And last but not least, in homage to Dorothea Lange, the photographer most famous for her incredibly empathetic images of Dust Bowl survivors. In this case, she also went and photographed many Japanese American families who were being evacuated. And what Shimomura has done with this image, and in fact the whole series, is recast Japanese Americans, people with American citizenship, as exotic others. And so what is charming is also very dark. Many of his images are documentary in the sense of they look back to photographs from his childhood, but of course recast them with the actual surroundings. So they're hybrid images in the sense that they combine his remembrances as a child, but his outrage as an adult. One of the images that we're very happy to have welcomed into the Jordan Schneftiri Museum of Art's permanent collection is this, called American Alien Number 3, in which you see Shimomura in silhouette and his mother, who is inside of the barracks, sweeping. And it's very difficult to see on this slide, but perhaps with this detail of the window in the background, you can see in the night sky outside, there are two strings of barbed wire that run past. Much of his imagery has to do with the imprisonment aspect and the thought of constantly being on surveillance, so under surveillance. So here you have an image that shows a bird's eye view from the guard tower looking down towards the internment camp. And this particular image breaks my heart because it makes use of another traditional Japanese pictorial trope, which is an image like this that shows a panoramic view of the city of Kyoto with many wonderful landmarks that visitors are enjoying in beautiful weather, and these golden clouds that float through the entire thing. Whereas what he's done is used the barracks of the camp and created this grid with the golden clouds, and the presumed bird's eye view of the Edo period painting and now becomes literally the binocular's eye view of the guard in the tower, looking down at that little boy on that tricycle, who we think we have to assume is Roger himself as a child. One of the largest works in the exhibition is this monumental painting, the American Infamy Number 5. And likewise, it is a view from the guard tower looking down across that expansive desert landscape. And beneath, there are many people of all different walks of life, different ages. You can tell there are different occupations. And the detail in the very center is that little boy on the tricycle looking out from the shadows between the barracks. The titles of many of Shimomura's works are evocative and compelling. American Soldier. This is not necessarily the picture that people would expect to see when you read that title. But in fact, this pays homage to the sad but illustrious history that Tara had mentioned of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And Shimomura has created another work in the exhibition from the series Minidoka and Beyond that is just called 442. And it is the hat seen of one of those soldiers with that distinctive patch, which is the hands of the Statue of Liberty holding that Porch of Liberty. But of course, you can see that that soldier is standing inside of a barrack, inside of barbed wire. Other ways that Shimomura is a pop artist, and he's used lots of pop cultural icons and juxtaposed them with these bright colors. And so there are a number of works from his Great American Muse series that take different aspects. In the piece on the right, a direct quotation from Roy Lichtenstein's famous image of a pistol, which is a compelling pop art image, but has a very different connotation if it's actually displayed inside of a barrack during the internment. That is, of course, anachronistic. The pop art was happening after the internment, but this is like a jazz musician kind of riffing on these different themes that he has. On the left, you see the beloved Disney characters kind of creepily peeking in, you know, voyeuristically watching what is going on within the barbed wire within those barracks. And the jokey part of Shimomura, the humorous part, has a potato. I think that is because Minidoka was in Idaho. Likewise, Hunt's tomato ketchup on the right, Hunt, Idaho. He has lots of issues of racism, discrimination, and identity. And his portrayal of mixed race couples is equally troubling. So you have a perhaps exoticized image of a Japanese woman with a Caucasian man and a horrible stereotype of a Japanese man with a Caucasian woman. One of the most poignant images in the show is his self-portrait called Kansas Samurai. So after graduating from college, Shimomura went and taught for 35 years, taught painting at the University of Kansas. And this was his self-portrait portrayal of what it felt like being there, kind of feeling alone. And he has expressed that through an effective use of many different comic book characters. So there's Superman, there's Dick Tracy, there's Dagwood, there's Popeye, there's Pluto and Donald Duck, all in shadow going the other direction. And here he's holding the sword for dear life. He's done a direct quotation from a famous work of art, this 1927 print by Natori Shunsen. But as you can see, that print focused on the actor and his presumed assailant outside of the shot. And there's no background. So Shimomura has effectively and creatively repurposed old art and combined them in different ways in order to create his own message, to tell his own story. His play with identity, he's kind of a shapeshifter, a trickster. He superimposes his face into iconic figures. On the left, of course, Superman. On the right, Ichikawa Danjiro, the hero of a kabuki play. And here he is goofing on this American knockoffs series. Likewise, he portrays himself as Superman in this American knockoffs, American versus Japanese number three. Here he is, of course, the American, although never perceived as American by other Americans in the United States. And here he's surrounded by all of these kabuki actors and samurai and sumo wrestlers, all armed to the teeth. His Minidoka and Beyond series, which we have juxtaposed in the exhibition with one of those original posters telling Japanese that they had to evacuate, goes into current history, and he juxtaposes all sorts of images. So I won't belabor this, but just wanted to point out that his interest is not just in the Japanese-American experience, but in the African-American experience. In September 11th, from the Japanese Americans' point of view of, oh no, don't let this happen to another group of people. The last series also deals with the border wall in Mexico and the treatment of Muslims. The treatment, anti-Jewish desecration of a cemetery, anti-gay legislation. So his anger and outrage is empathetic, and he continues it to other groups who could likewise be profiled and discriminated against. So I think I will end there just saying that Roger is a shapeshifter, and we are so pleased to have this exhibition and this opportunity to discuss this with such fabulous context provided by Tara and Amy. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. The question was, how has the internment of the Japanese American affected me personally? I had a very different maybe perspective on it because I was born and raised on Hawaii. And as it turned out, my father worked for the Navy. He did heavy construction for the Navy at the time, and he was actually at Pearl Harbor during the attack, and it was a very traumatic emotional experience because he saw the rising sun on the bellies of the planes that were attacking. He saw the USS Oklahoma capsize. And we didn't hear about this until about the 1990s. I had no idea that he had gone through that. And then, because we were third generation, we were the Sanseis, and everybody wanted to be Americanized after the war, and the Japanese Americans were the majority population in Hawaii. Consequently, when you're the dominant group, you have certain privileges, and you know, all your friends and everything was Japanese American, and so we had an attitude that was very, very different. We grew up with the myth that there were so many of us, they couldn't intern us. And in fact, Admiral Chester Nimitz kind of backed everybody away and said, you cannot incarcerate the Japanese Americans in Hawaii. Nothing will run. And so we grew up with that myth. And in the 2000s, we discovered that actually, after all the, say, Japanese nationals, the community leaders were interned and taken to the mainland and incarcerated, there were approximately 2,000 Japanese Americans who were imprisoned at Honouliuli, internment camp just around near Pearl Harbor. And nothing was ever said by those families. These were our friends and neighbors. Nothing was ever said because they were ashamed of being interned and imprisoned. When we found out, however, we were outraged. We were lied to. We were not allowed to take care of our friends and neighbors. And consequently, we were also in the same history as the Japanese Americans on the mainland. So our histories began to intersect, and our causes were common. And this allowed me, I've been here for 50 years, active in the Asian American community. I am president of the Japanese American community, and I, when the Eugene Japanese American Memorial was being created, I said, you know what, I'm busy enough. I don't need this. This is not my history. Suddenly, it became my history. And I embraced it. And I was able to embrace the history of my Auntie Flo, who was 23 years old, student at Oregon State University, young girl from Hawaii, got married on May 1st, 1942, to my uncle. And by May 5th, they were at the Pacific Exposition Center, the racetrack in Portland, and on their way to Minidoka. I was able only 2 years ago to thank my aunt. She's 102 years old, for her resilience. And this has caused me, I think, for all of us to be here talking about the internment and how important it is, because it is. It causes us to act, to stand united with the other communities who are under attack. We all need to be together, united.
Well, the question was about the effect of the Japanese American internment. And I was not interned. I am actually, I suppose, in a peculiar and very strange way, grateful, because my parents met at Minidoka. My father was a Japanese Episcopal minister, fresh off the boat, and was picked up the night that Pearl Harbor was bombed and sent to a Department of Justice camp in Santa Fe, and spent time there before he was finally sent to Minidoka, where he became the Episcopal minister. And there he met and fell in love with a young government-funded American sociologist. And many years later, they had me. But when I was a little girl, I remember coming home just outraged and saying to my father, "Did you know that the U.S. government incarcerated people of Japanese descent?" And he said, "Yes, dear, I was aware of that." And it was only at that moment that I realized that when they talked about camp, their camp was not the same as my camp. My camp was a voluntary camp that people paid good money to send their children to the country and have fun and do things. And their camp was involuntary and, as it happens, unconstitutional. So I'm very proud of the fact that artists like Roger Shimomura and different authors and many people who are not creating art but just going out and doing civil activities are striving for social justice, because even though the Japanese American internment happened at a bounded time in a specific place, the same sorts of issues are happening all over. And it's really important that people stand up. And I admire the fact that Shimomura, although he clearly uses internment imagery, he's using it to talk to larger, immediate social issues. And for that, it was a privilege to work on the show. And it's wonderful to be able to have this opportunity to talk to the City Club of Eugene about it.
This has been our May 15th program, The Lasting Impact of Internment on Japanese Americans. I'd like to recognize some gold sponsors: Evans, Elder, Brown, and Subert, Gatos, Churnsides, and Balthrop, PC, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, Hearing Associates. It is our expectation to have the taped conversations available by Fridays at noon. We want to thank you all for supporting us during this difficult time. Before we thank our speakers today, there are a few quick announcements. Thank you to our in-kind sponsors: KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography, Network Charter School, and to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Plug programs on Monday at our new time, 7 p.m., at least when not preempted by NPR coronavirus coverage. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. We are hosting a video for more information about living inside the internment camps and a resilience story upon returning to civilian life. City Club member Barbara Dotte has shared a video by her mother, Florence Dotte Smith. Florence was interned at the Topaz War Relocation Center, also known as the Central Utah Relocation Center. You can find it on our website and Facebook pages.
The family welcomes your feedback
at paxdate@gmail.com. Next week, we will take a break for the Memorial Day weekend, but we will be back the following week, May 29th, for our program, Knowledge Production at the University of Oregon: What Have Students Been Up To? In this second annual celebration of student academic achievements, we will hear from three University of Oregon undergraduate students: Kylie Brewer, a history major, who will talk to us about student engagement and the evolving college classroom; John Francis, a biology major, who will talk to us about 3D printing and its application toward healthcare, and Rennie Kendrick, another biology major with an emphasis on neuroscience, who will talk to us about her research on memory. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now let's thank the speakers, Tara Fickle, Amy Yogi, and Anne Rose Kitagawa. Thank you very much for your presentations. This concludes today's program. Please join us next week on our Facebook page.